In the opening verses of John's Gospel, it is written, "The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it." In a world in which so many voices and conversations offer a great deal of heat, but little light, your friends at 1517.org invite you to explore its podcasting network of 20 different shows. Do you have an interest in Christian history? Then Christian History Almanac will surely interest you. This five-minute podcast consists of stories from the past about men and women, saints and sinners all, who helped shape the great tradition of Christianity. The show is brief, always concludes with a moving piece of prose or poetry, and most importantly, a reminder that everything is going to be okay. Are you looking for meaty conversations on theology, the movers and shakers of church history, and Christian apologetics? If so, check out the original show, The Thinking Fellows, going on 7 years now. The fellows are sure to hold your interest. Perhaps you are looking for smart and engaging studies of the Bible. Then check out 30 Minutes in the New Testament or 40 Minutes in the Old Testament or both. These and a host of other 1517 podcasts are all available across every major podcasting platform, as well as at 1517.org. That's 1517.org. In each and every case, you will receive not only engaging talk, but most importantly, you will receive Christ Jesus, the crucified and risen Savior, Christ Jesus, the light of the world. Welcome to the McCarthy Report, the podcast where I, Rich Lowry, discuss with Andy McCarthy the latest legal and national security issues this week. What else? The Waukesha killings and the Arbery case. You are, of course, listening to a National View podcast. If you listen to this podcast on nationalview.com, we're delighted to have you. But it'd be easier for you and better for us if you made us part of your feed at any of the streaming services out there, from Spotify to iTunes. And please give this podcast and Andy McCarthy the glowing, indeed gushing, 5-star reviews they deserve on iTunes. And now, through the miracle of Zoom, I welcome to this very podcast none other than Andy McCarthy.
Hey, Rich, how are you?
Good, Andy. How's it going? Happy Thanksgiving.
Man, happy Thanksgiving. I am so glad we're talking on Tuesday. I'm really glad we're doing this today because I think we need some Thanksgiving. The cases that we've had to talk about lately, just, you know, I mean, I've sort of generally knew they were going on, but I dove into the details of them more for purposes of the podcast so we could have a decent discussion of them. And man, it's just like one miserable, heartbreaking, awful story after another. And it's as we saw now with this, is it Waukesha? Is that how they?
Waukesha.
Waukesha. Man, that's just a terrible.
Yeah.
Well, it's a terrible story.
So what's important to know about that one?
Well, as we speak on Tuesday morning, my understanding is he's going to be the name of the guy who they have arrested is Brooks, Daryl Brooks, and he is a career criminal, and he's being presented today in court for at least. So far, there are five who have been killed. So it will be five counts, they say, of intentional murder. My understanding is, in all, there are 48 people who've been injured. And just so I'm sure most of our listeners know this already, but this is a place where on Sunday they were having an annual Christmas celebration. And it was a very festive mood because, like a lot of other places in the country, there, you know, it's one more way of getting back to normal after a crazy year plus of COVID. So they're having their annual celebration. And this character, who apparently was in some kind of a fight, which is not evidently unusual for him, sped away from the fight that he was in, and then came upon this parade and rammed his SUV through people who were performing in the parade. And then the crowd, which was said to be like two or three columns deep in some places on the streets of the town. So five people, mostly elderly people, were killed. And there are, as I said, at least 48 others who've been injured. Some of them are very seriously injured. So obviously it's entirely possible as we head into the Thanksgiving holiday that more families could lose some of their loved ones. And this is a guy, Rich, who just like absolutely positively should not have been on the street. I mean, my own law enforcement impulse is that yeah, he should have been incarcerated some time ago and somebody should have thrown the key away. He's that kind of a character. So he's got a long record. He's wanted for this, that, and the other thing. He had one case in Milwaukee recently, and this is pretty outrageous, where he was wanted for he was indicted for two felonies. Bail was set for him at $10,000, reduced to $7,500. He couldn't make those bails. One of the offenses, I think, is a battery, and the other one has to do with possession of a weapon, which in his status he shouldn't have been allowed to possess. You've got just a violent history. But in the COVID era, he demanded a speedy trial, and the state couldn't give him a speedy trial. And the district attorney's office in Milwaukee is run by this progressive prosecutor type named John Chisholm, whose claim to fame is he is a pioneer against cash bail, which he says criminalizes poverty and exacerbates systemic racism in the United States. So to make a long story short, in terms of the application of this philosophy, the state could not get it together because of, I think everything was backed up. This is a problem in courts all across the country. Everything was backed up because of COVID. And COVID's been a big problem, people should understand, for speedy trial issues in general, because there haven't been, grand juries haven't been able to sit. Courts have been in various states of restrictions. It's fairly recent that trials have started up again on a more regular schedule, so there's a big backup. But to make a long story short, they couldn't give the guy the speedy trial that he demanded. So instead of trying otherwise to resolve the case, they decided to knock his bail down to $500, which he, of course, made. So he then got out on bail. And just 3 weeks ago, there was an incident in which he allegedly beat up the mother of his child. And this assault, evidently, according to the police report, includes having run her over in a gas station parking lot on November 2nd. So in connection with that, he was arrested again. And rather than being held, the district attorney's office released him on $1,000 bail. And that is why he was out and able to commit this horrible, horrible crime.
So basically twice he was out on low bail.
Correct.
And right. So what do you make of the argument? I haven't followed the bail discussion closely, except for, you know, it's been obviously been a disaster in New York and other places. But I imagine the argument is, well, if he doesn't have $5,000, he'll just be in jail forever.
Yeah, well, see, Rich, here's the thing, and you've written about this in the last few days, and I'm totally persuaded by this, and I've tried to make this argument similarly myself. We're either going to have a criminal justice system which is based on fact and real threat assessment, or we're going to have a racialized morality play, but you can't have both. Mm-hmm. So I feel like, you know, I don't mean to sound a little weary about this, but I feel like recently in the last year or so of the podcast, there's many weeks where we come in and what we end up discussing is this kind of collision between the left's depiction of the justice system and the reality of the justice system. And what happens when you take things like, for example, just because we just talked about it, the Rittenhouse scenario, and you try to make it into a morality play, and then you move the morality play into a courtroom where you actually have, you know, rules of evidence and due process, and you have to prove stuff, and it's not enough to go in and wave the bloody shirt on whatever political narrative you happen to be running that week. And I think what we're seeing, because of the importance and extensive way that the criminal justice system runs through our society, because if we don't have a good system, we can't have the rule of law. If we don't have the rule of law, we can't have a prosperous society. So whether it's in connection with investigations, arrests, what you do with people who you've arrested, the setting of bail, how you dispose of cases, how you try cases, and the kinds of sentences people get, and the system in which they're incarcerated. At every single stage here, if you're going to have a racialized narrative about all of it, it's going to be forever colliding into reality. And the interesting thing with this guy Chisholm, we were talking about this a little bit before we started. He gave it, this guy's a true believer, except now, of course, he's I mean, now that the worst and the most predictable, predicted even by him, has happened, he's running for the hills. But in 2007, he gave an interview to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, because he's a crusader on no cash bail. And for the narrative is the very thing that you just asked me about, which is, you know, this whole idea that people who just don't have the money to get out on bail end up in jail because of their financial straits rather than justice. And let me just finish the story of what he said and then come back to that argument. What he said in 2007 was, is it inevitable that somebody who I divert is going to go out and commit murder? And he said, of course it is, but that doesn't mean that it's not worth doing what we're doing and trying to get rid of cash bail and lower incarcerations and keep people out of prison. So in 2007, in the abstract, he said, yes, you know, one murder or a series of murders wouldn't be worth abandoning the project of bringing more equity to the justice system. Well, now that we have a situation where somebody who should have been in prison has murdered five people on Sunday, suddenly he then comes out and says, well, this is a situation where obviously the bail was too low, so we'll be conducting an investigation. And I'm like, an investigation of what? Your own office? Mm-hmm. I mean, why do you think the bail is too low? Why do you think that the assistant district attorneys who work for this guy think that it's okay to set low bail for people who should be in jail? Because the boss has set the tone, and this is his project, and it's been his project for longer than a decade. As for whether cash bail is a penalty for, it turns out in reality to be a penalty for being poor as opposed to being accused of a crime, there's a doctrine of law, Rich, that says nobody is supposed to be in jail because they can't afford to get out of bail. In other words, bail is not supposed to be set so high that in effect it means you can't get out because you're poor, as opposed to other reasons. There's a variety of offender and offense characteristics that a court is supposed to look at in setting bail. And one of the factors involved is obviously somebody's means, because, you know, if somebody if a billionaire commits a crime, you wouldn't set $15,000 cash bail if you thought he had the means to flee the jurisdiction and never come back again. You would have to set higher cash bail because of the person's means. So obviously means play a factor in this, but bail gets set in accordance with not only what your means are, but your criminal history, the nature of the crime that you've been arrested for, and also whether people are willing to step up to the plate and guarantee that you will come back to court and make all your court appearances and that you won't violate the law while you're out on release. So all of these things factor in. And what the left would have you believe is that cash bail gets set in order to keep Black people in jail. But now let's put race on the side and just deal with Brooks's criminal record. Would anyone looking at Brooks's criminal record think he was in jail because he was Black? Mm-hmm. Really? I mean, it's ridiculous.
So let's go to the Arbery case. And it's a little arbitrary which of these cases really pops. I mean, there's been a fair amount of attention on Arbery, but nothing like there was with Rittenhouse. But you've been paying attention to it and recording Tuesday morning, and closing arguments are today, or have been today, or yesterday?
As we're speaking, Rich, this is late morning. The prosecutor just finished her rebuttal summation, and the judge is charging the jury. So probably by the time we're done with the podcast, the jury will have the case.
Okay.
So yesterday you had a whole day of summations.
Okay. So let me give you my thumbnail version of what I know as someone who has just been following it very loosely and picking up bits and pieces on cable news, which means I'm probably not very well informed and in fact, probably misinformed in some respects. But Arbery's jogging, goes to a house that I guess is under construction. There's a surveillance video. There have been reports of problems there, thefts, but he doesn't take anything. He's just going on his way, and these guys chase him down, and he has reason to be afraid of them. Attacks one of the guys who shoots him. And is that the 15-second version?
Yeah, that is the 15-second version. What's come out in the summations, Rich, just to fill out the picture a little bit more, is that there's a lot of suspicion, which is not crazy suspicion, about Ahmad Arbery. The prosecution has presented him as a young Black man who happened to be jogging through the streets when he was cornered by the people who ultimately ended up killing him. The defense has pointed out that it's more complicated than that. This is a community in Glynn County. It's coastal Georgia, kind of an exurb of Savannah, where the community over the last couple of years has seen a sharp increase in crime, particularly property crime. And it has changed, at least in the defense telling, it's changed the way that people live there in terms of, you know, letting their kids go out and play at night, and, you know, but the places are as safe as they used to be. And there's a lot of reports of property crime. So this fellow, Larry English, who does not live in Glynn County in this community that we're talking about, which is called Satilla Shores. He doesn't live there now. He lives about 2 hours away, but he's building a house there. And his idea was to move there when his dream house is completed. So there's a construction site there. The house is about half built. There's other stuff on the property, including a boat. And reportedly, there have been thousands of dollars of stuff, particularly off the boat, that has been stolen from this lot. So much so that he set up surveillance cameras in the home. And in the surveillance, they have captured this guy, Ahmad Arbery, on four occasions prior to the day that he is killed. The day he's killed, I should point out, is February 23rd, 2020, which is a Sunday afternoon. So there's theft going on there. This guy Arbery is there. The story that he's a jogger is not really supported by any evidence.
Oh, so he wasn't jogging?
Well, he was running away from the home when he was being chased. That's for sure. But you know, to the extent that they were going to,
just like jogging by the home necessarily. He was just looking in.
Yeah. And I think his original story, or the original story about him, I should say, was that he was jogging in the neighborhood, that he's an avid runner. And that's the press account, but none of that came into the trial. They didn't have, one of the things the defense pointed out was they didn't have anybody who came in to testify that this guy is an avid jogger. So what's come into evidence about him is they don't have any evidence that he committed a crime other than he's in a place that he's not supposed to be. Technically speaking, you don't have to steal anything to be guilty of burglary. On the other hand, this is not really a home. This is a construction site, and he's not the only person who's been in and out of it. And the police did have surveillance photos of him that were taken from the English surveillance cameras, English being the guy, again, who owns the lot. So that brings us to who these defendants are. Greg McMichael, who I believe is in his mid to late 60s, is a retired cop, and he's also very tied in. He was an investigator for many years in the Glynn County District Attorney's Office, which ends up being the ones who investigate this case. And he, on one of the prior occasions, Rich, sees Arbery in the property. Not on the day of the, he sees him on that day too, but I'm talking about a separate incident where at night he finds Arbery poking around the property. He shines his lights on him. He's in a, McMichael is in his car, Greg McMichael, and he shines his headlights on him, and Arbery perceives that he's being followed or watched. According to McMichael's story, he reaches into his waistband as if he had a weapon, but McMichael can't say that he saw a weapon, can't say that he saw him take anything. Calls 911, McMichael does, to say that there's a person who doesn't have any reason to be there trespassing on this property, that they know there's been property theft from, but the guy takes off and leaves before the police can get there.
Is there a record of that call?
There is a record of that call, of the 911 call. And I believe it was played in evidence in the trial. I should tell people that while I watched a lot of the second half of the Rittenhouse trial, I did not watch any of the Arbery trial, which was going on at the same time as the Rittenhouse trial, unless I was on Fox and they happened to be showing it. And I have watched some of the summations in the last couple of days just to try to get a sense of where the argument was going. Cause it is, and I caution people, it's always much, you always have a much different impression from watching the trial than you do reading reports about the trial. We try here to do the best we can to be accurate about what's going on, but there's nothing like watching a trial. So anyhow, on February 23rd, so that's the state of play. And the other thing that's important here, Rich, is there is a, there's a principle of law called the citizen's arrest. And it was the law of, there's actually a statute about it, which was repealed or substantially changed after this incident. But they were, you were allowed to make citizen's arrests in Georgia. The thing is, with a citizen's arrest, you have to have the same thing a police officer has to have to make a citizen's arrest, which is probable cause that a crime has been or is being committed. And, you know, to be real here, the idea of a citizen's, of permitting citizen's arrests are like, for example, you see a guy swipe a woman's purse on the street, and people chase him to try to get the purse back. You see this happen from time to time, and they tackle the person and hold them down until the cops can come and arrest them and take them away. That's the normal citizen's arrest situation. In other words, you don't have to just sit there and watch a crime get committed and do nothing. You can detain someone that you're sure has committed a crime until the police can come and do their job. So the important aspect of this principle for this discussion is, in order to make a valid citizen's arrest, you have to have probable cause that the person committed a crime. And what McMichael saw, here's what happens on February 23rd in a nutshell. It's Sunday afternoon. McMichael, Greg, he's the elder. And the reason I'm stressing that is because the other important actor here is his son, Travis, who ultimately is the one who fires the shot that kills Aubrey. Greg McMichael sees Aubrey coming out of this property again, and basically says to his son, it's that guy again. Let's go try to stop him. So Greg McMichael takes his 357 Magnum handgun, and Travis McMichael grabs his Remington rifle, and they get in their truck, like a Ram truck or that kind of a vehicle, and they try to chase this guy down to stop him. And as they're in the process of doing this, their neighbor, whose name is Roddy Bryan, his actual name is William, but everyone calls him Roddy. He sees what the McMichaels are up to, and he decides to join the chase to help them try to corner this guy. He decides to take video of some of it. And the reason that we have video ultimately of Travis McMichael shooting Aubrey is because this guy, Roddy Bryan, in addition to joining the chase, is also taking some video. So to make a long story short, they try to chase him down. They're screaming at him. They're telling him he needs to stop. And of course, they're not the police. They're not dressed like the police. They don't have any real authority to tell him that he has to stop. They don't have any authority to make him speak to them. They haven't seen him commit a crime, at least not a theft. Now, there's a kind of a legal issue in the case. As I mentioned before, to commit burglary, you don't actually have to steal anything. You just have to be, you have to basically break into a place where you don't belong and you don't have a right to be. But in this instance, it's a real gray area, Rich, because it's not a normal home. It's a construction site. Mm-hmm. And it's not like this guy, Aubrey, is the only guy who's gone through the construction site. Lots of people have gone through the construction site. And as the evidence in the trial came out, there's some evidence that they've identified or think they've identified somebody who actually stole some of the stuff. And it's not Aubrey. It's somebody else. But nevertheless, he's not supposed to be there. There have been a raft of thefts. And even though they haven't seen him take anything, you know, you can draw an inference where, you know, somebody is someplace they're not supposed to be at night. And the next morning, the guy notices that there's stuff missing. You know, you can sort of, it's a rational inference that he was probably involved in the theft, but they don't have proof of that. So anyway, they decide to start to chase this guy. And the reason I want to stress that there's vagueness about why they're chasing him is because when this ultimately comes to an end and Aubrey is shot, one of the statements that the McMichaels make to the police were basically asking, why were you chasing this guy? And they essentially say, well, we were going to hold him for the police. And they're like, hold him for what? And they say, well, we didn't see him take anything. And I'm not really sure he was in there. I saw him in the vicinity of this place where he wasn't supposed to be. So it becomes very vague. I mean, there's kind of a general impression of why they think he's up to no good. But to call this probable cause of a crime is very shaky. And another difference that I would want to stress to people about on probable cause and the difference between a citizen's arrest and a police arrest. There's a doctrine of law that says when the police make a stop, they have the knowledge not only of whatever the cop on the street observes, but also what the police in general, as a police force, know collectively, right? Whereas if you make a citizen's arrest, it's on the basis of what you know. You don't get the benefit of like everything the police force knows. So let me give you another example that weighs in here from time to time. If you saw somebody on the street, you know, guy walks over to the driver of a car and they shake hands and they chat, and then the guy in the car drives away. You don't know what you've seen other than two guys shake hands and have a conversation. If a police officer who's been walking the beat there and the community police force that's been policing there knows that this is a drug area and that it's a common practice for people to look like they're shaking hands, but what they're really doing is exchanging, you know, cash and vials of some narcotics, what the police officer observes is different from what the normal person observes, because the police officer brings to bear all of the things that the police know as an entity, whereas the person making a citizen's arrest better be sure he's seen a crime. So that's kind of what comes into play here. So they, to make a long story short, they do this chase. They coordinate the trucks, and also it's obvious to Aubrey that he's got to be careful where he runs because the McMichaels are clearly armed. So they do the chase in a way that narrows Aubrey's way of getting away. And finally, they have him pretty much cornered. He comes popping out of someplace along the passenger side of the McMichaels truck. And by now, Travis McMichael is out of the truck. Now, Travis McMichael is the son, as I mentioned before. He's a Coast Guard veteran. He was a boarding officer in the Coast Guard. So he's had some law enforcement type training, which he tried to play up big in the trial. So there's some dispute about how this all happened and how close Aubrey got to him. But basically, Aubrey decides the only way out is through. So he decides to rush McMichael. McMichael fires at him when he's rushing at him. McMichael, now, this is Travis. Now, Travis now says that McMichael, I'm sorry, Travis now says that Aubrey grabbed his rifle and tried to get it away from him, and that's when he shot him. But when he gave a statement to the police after this all happened, he didn't claim that happened. And the ballistics seemed to suggest that it was further away than Aubrey getting his.
Is there video of the actual shooting?
There is from Brian, and the video, which is not the clearest thing. It's a little bit shaky, but it seems to support the idea that there was some distance between Travis and Aubrey at the time the shooting took place.
So a key question, I imagine, is going to be who the aggressor was, because Aubrey right. would have reason to think they're the aggressors. And when Arbery's charging Travis, is that the
correct?
You have reason to think Aubrey's the aggressor.
Right. Now, the other thing that plays in here, Rich, is something we talked about in connection with Rittenhouse, which is what to make of the chase of Aubrey. Because if these guys didn't have lawful authority, what the state has charged here is that they're guilty of assault and false imprisonment. Because if they didn't have probable cause to make an arrest, they're both assaulting Aubrey with these cars, which they almost run him over in a couple of times, and they're trying to hold him. And if they don't have grounds to hold him, that's false imprisonment. So this is relevant because as we heard the prosecution argue in the Rittenhouse case, if you have committed a felony in connection with setting up the confrontation that results in somebody rushing you, you may have forfeited your right to engage in self-defense. In other words, if I provoke you by committing a felony against you, and then you rush me, I don't have a right to, you know, whether I have a right to defend myself is very debatable. And then the other issue here, of course, is Aubrey is unarmed. And if he's rushing me, and I, you know, nothing else is, I haven't tried anything else in the way of detaining him at this point. He's now rushing me and I just blow him away. And I'm the one who created the situation right. by, as the state would have it, committing a crime against him, the crime of assault and false imprisonment. So they're arguing, much like we heard in the state is arguing in Georgia, much like we heard the state argue in the Rittenhouse case, that or what they wanted to argue was that if he committed a felony or if he was responsible as the aggressor for having caused the confrontation, then he loses his right of self-defense. That was not a very good argument in the Rittenhouse case. It's an excellent argument in the Aubrey case.
So just to be clear, that argument, the Rittenhouse case, that argument in and of itself, in theory, is not a bogus argument. It's just that the facts weren't there.
Correct.
So they're trying to make it first. They're trying to make it having the gun illegally into this felonious act of aggression. And then they're making it, then subsequently they try to make it pointing the gun based on this grainy enhanced video.
Right. Yes. And we should, you raise an important point. So why we should nail this. Remember in the Rittenhouse case, the judge did instruct the jury on provocation. The judge gave the jury the instruction that the state asked for, which was this idea that if Rittenhouse had provoked the confrontation, that he would lose his right of self-defense. So Rittenhouse is acquitted not because the judge rejected the state's theory of law, but because the jury felt that the facts did not prove provocation. The facts showed that Rittenhouse was not the aggressor. He was the one being chased. Here, I think it's a very different calculation. And there's some disturbing stuff that happens after the shooting. Not that the shooting itself is not very disturbing. While Aubrey is lying dead in the street, and everybody is now starting to panic over what happened, Greg McMichael, who of course worked at the DA's office, calls the district attorney. And to make a long story short, they basically interfere after this call with the district attorney, who has since been charged with basically violating her oath and also obstruction of justice. But they don't charge these three guys for months. She basically tries to close the case as a case of citizen's arrest and self-defense shooting. And they don't do a complete forensic investigation of the crime scene, including basic things like taking photographs of the vehicles that were involved in the chase and that sort of thing. So there's no charges that are brought in this case for a very, very long time. So that's one thing. The other thing is there are police interviews of the McMichaels. And basically, Travis McMichaels makes a police statement that is at odds in many important ways with the version of events. He testified at the trial, and his version of events at the trial is very different from what he told the police, night and day in some particulars. And what he now argues is he was very confused and upset at the time he spoke to the police when he told them, for example, he'd like to be able to say that Aubrey grabbed his gun, but he's not able to say that. Now, when he's on the stand, he's sure that Aubrey grabbed the gun. So there's important differences there. But the other interesting thing is Greg McMichael is asked by the cops, well, what were you stopping him for? You know, you were making a citizen's arrest. What was the crime that you were stopping him for? And they couldn't identify a crime. They said, you know, basically, we didn't see him take anything. It sure looks awful suspicious. And with all the stuff that's gone on in this neighborhood, it seemed very suspicious. And ultimately, his story gets down to basically he was trying to hold him till the cops came in the hopes that the cops could at least identify him for future purposes, which is not a valid reason for making a citizen's arrest. So that's problematic. And what I think I see the McMichaels trying to do in their defense is to glom on to the principle of probable cause that I just mentioned a few minutes ago, which is to say, forget about what we knew in the moment on Sunday, February 23rd, when we couldn't tell the police what crime we were trying to arrest him for. And now let's focus on everything that we might have known going up to February 23rd, including the fact that there was this raft of property crimes in the neighborhood, the fact that there was stuff that was stolen on other occasions from the English property, the fact that McMichael saw Aubrey in the English property on one other occasion where, you know, he couldn't say that he was taking anything, but he didn't belong there. And then seeing him sprint away from the property, looking like he might be acting suspiciously and have done something wrong, but the McMichaels can't say exactly what it was that he did wrong. So what they're trying to do now is kind of after the fact say, well, if we construct everything that everybody must have known going into February 23rd, that comes out to probable cause that he committed technical burglary, even if we can't say that he stole anything. That's their story. I don't think I'd be very surprised if the jury buys it, but that's where they're going.
Well, at the very least, it was very foolhardy to pursue him, right? I mean, it's one thing to chase him away from the property or take video and photographs and try to apprise people, the cop later, you know, be on the lookout for this guy, but try to run him down with your guns and arrest him was not a formula for anything good happening.
Yeah, I'd say one thing though. I think these guys should be convicted based on what I know about the case, which is reading a lot and watching the summations, not seeing the testimony. I saw some of Travis's testimony, but not enough to form a strong opinion about it. But based on everything I've read about it, I think they should be convicted. I think it would be a just verdict to convict. I should tell everybody what they're charged with. I'm sorry, I never got into that, but they're charged with one count of malice murder, which is another thing that's been twisted in the coverage. The coverage obviously has tried to turn this into just a racial thing. There's nothing more to it than these are white guys and the guy they shot was black and that's the end of the story. That's what you're supposed to believe. And they have glommed in making that argument into the idea that the first count that these guys are all charged with is called malice murder. And if that's not further explained to you, common sense would forgive you for assuming that what they mean is racial malice or racial prejudice. But it doesn't have anything to do with that. In Georgia, they don't use the term intentional homicide. Malice murder, there's two different kinds of malice murder. One of them is what we traditionally think of as intentional homicide, which is, basically I say, I'm going to kill that guy, and then I grab a gun and I kill him. That's intentional murder, right? You can know from provable circumstances that that I had the intention to murder this person, then I followed through and I did do it. So that's what's known as express malice murder. And then there's a second kind that's called implied malice murder. And that's, Rich, along the lines of what we discussed in the Chauvin case, the idea of depraved indifference. So there's two kinds of implied malice murder. One is I completely overreact under the circumstances and use a degree of force that is in no way been provoked and is clearly excessive. And that would be like you bump into me, whether you do it on purpose or by accident, and I pull out a gun and blow your brains out. You know, that's like completely ridiculous, right? And then the other kind is the more traditional depraved indifference situation, which we discussed a lot with Chauvin, where somebody shoots a gun into a crowd, you're not trying to kill any particular person, but you're completely heedless of the danger that you're creating, and somebody dies. So that's what malice murder is. It doesn't have anything to do with race. It's just a function of Georgia law that they don't use the word intent. They use malice. So that's what it is. And then there's eight other counts in the indictment, Rich. Four of them are felony murder. And just to remind people, a felony murder is a murder that's committed when you don't intend to commit murder, but you're in the course of committing another felony and a murder or a killing happens. You know, I go to rob a store, and as I'm taking stuff, the store owner interrupts me, and I end up shooting him. I didn't intend to shoot the store owner, but I killed him in the course of another robbery. That's of another felony. That's felony murder. So the eight other counts are four counts of felony murder and the four underlying felonies that trigger the felony murder. And those are two counts of assault and two counts of false imprisonment. One is, I think, actual false imprisonment, and the other one is attempted false imprisonment. But the state is basically telling the jury, you can convict these guys of murder on either of these two theories, either by finding that this was an intentional murder that was, I'm sorry, not an intentional murder, but a murder that under the circumstances was way, way excessive force for what the circumstances called for, or you can find that they assaulted him in the course of the police chase and tried to falsely imprison him, and in the course of committing those felonies, he was killed. So those are the two theories that they're going by. And what they've basically tried to do in the media coverage is turn this into a racial situation, such that, you know, essentially the media story here is, this is a quiet, predominantly white town in coastal exurban Savannah, and they saw a black guy running down the street and they killed him. I mean, that's basically what the narrative is. So what I would stress to people, and I wrote a column about this for the site yesterday, it is not, no one could say that there isn't conceivably a racial element here. And there is some evidence that's come into the case about race. For example, Travis McMichael had a vanity plate that has the old Georgia flag, that has the imagery of the Confederate battle flag on it. The state wants people to deduce from that he had racial animus. What he would say is that it's perfectly legal in Georgia to display that as a vanity plate, and that it's redolent of the history of the state, and that the familiar argument that we've heard a million times, that it's not about racism, it's like part of Southern heritage. So that's what they would say. The other thing that they've tried to make a big deal out of, Rich, is Greg McMichael, when he made his call to the police, said that there was a black guy running down the street away from the house. So what the district attorney made a big deal out of is that Greg McMichael stressed that it was a black guy running down the street, didn't say that he had done anything. Now, first of all, McMichael is making a 911 call. And the reason he's making a 911 call is because he thinks that this guy, Aubrey, has stolen stuff from the house. So under the circumstances, it's obvious he's calling to report a crime. He's not calling to report that there's a black guy running down the street. So I thought it was a kind of a distorted picture. And then I heard the 911 call. And I think the reason that McMichael never said that he suspected that the guy had robbed from the house is because the 911 dispatcher interrupted him when he said there was a black guy running down the street. The dispatcher interrupts him in the middle of that, so he doesn't complete his thought, and then the conversation goes in a different direction. So, pardon the pun, but it's not as black and white as the as the coverage contends it is. And the reason I lay all that out is I'm not saying there's not a racial component to this case and that you can't bring racial baggage to it. And is it a fair thing to say that the McMichaels, if they had seen a white guy running down the street, they would have thought differently about it than the fact that it was a 25-year-old black guy? Maybe if that's all they knew, you could say that they would be less inclined to think a white guy was causing a problem than the black guy. I think when you look at the whole evidence in the record, they had a lot of reason to be suspicious of Aubrey. But it's one thing to say that there may be race working its way into this, but this case is not about white guys see a black guy and shoot him because he's a black guy. It's a case of these guys tried to make a citizen's arrest under circumstances where they didn't have a legal basis to make a citizen's arrest. And the guy got shot under circumstances where even if there was a valid basis to use some kind of self-defense, to go to lethal force under those circumstances was excessive. And that's what it's about. It's about basically a mistaken false arrest or a mistaken citizen's arrest and a mistaken use of force. To say that it's three white guys who saw a black guy running down the street and that's why they decided they had to kill him is just, it's not what the case is about.
Okay, Andy, let's hit a few other things. So going back to Rittenhouse, you have Jerry Nadler calling on Merrick Garland, Attorney General, to indict Rittenhouse. How realistic is this? What would be the legal basis of it?
Yeah, well, that's why I just did my long diatribe on race in connection with Aubrey, Rich, because I would have laughed at this from Nadler, except then I read the Justice Department's indictment, which they have filed against the three defendants in the Aubrey case, who no matter what happens in the state case, the Justice Department is intending to prosecute these guys for civil rights penalty or civil rights crimes under circumstances where a potential penalty for at least for the McMichaels, not for Brian, but for the McMichaels, potentially it's a death penalty case. If you read the Justice Department's indictment, the charge is that by force and intimidation, and in a case where the special circumstances, death was caused, they deprived Aubrey because of his race, and explicitly it's because of his race, of the enjoyment of a public benefit. That is, he was running on a city street, which he was allowed to do. So they have obviously a very broad idea of what a civil right is for these purposes. But their theory of the case is that Aubrey was black. The defendants are white. It explicitly says this in the indictment. And if you look in the indictment, which is not terribly long, you will look high and low to see if there's any evidence whatsoever pled in the indictment that the McMichaels had racial animus. There is nothing in the indictment that says that. So the Justice Department's theory here is that because the defendants were white, and the victim is black, we should infer that this was generated or motivated by racial prejudice. So if that's what they're running with, I think people should be very frightened by that because, number one, what they're trying to do is use the Justice Department to prosecute the left's theory about systemic racism in America, because there's no other motive other than the happenstance that there's a difference in race between the shooter, between the assailants and the victim. And as laughable as I think Jerry Nadler is by suggesting that there should be a civil rights indictment against Rittenhouse, If the Justice Department would bring the kind of indictment they brought in the Aubrey case, I don't think you could put anything past them. So Nadler's theory would be that Rittenhouse deprived the four people that he shot at of the of both the enjoyment of the public streets and their right to protest under the First Amendment, and that he did it out of racial animus. And the racial animus you would have to deduce from that, since everybody's white, is that somehow vicariously, because the four people who were shot were involved in protests against the police shooting of Jacob Blake, who is Black, somehow they become like shooting Black people out of racial hatred. Now, if it takes that long to explain something this convoluted, it shouldn't really be something that belongs in court. But I have to say, Rich, this Justice Department is so hyper politicized and racialized. Can I sit here and say there's no way that they will bring this case? I can't.
So, Andy, let's get to one last thing that we've been meaning to get to, but haven't the last podcast or two, which is the indictment of Steve Bannon. So he's refused this congressional subpoena, and we went very quickly from there to this Justice Department act.
Yeah, Rich, this is a very different kind of a story, because I'm going to say the Justice Department is hyper-politicized. I know it's very different from our other the other cases that we've dealt with, but I really think this is a very politicized indictment. Just so people understand, this is not about Steve Bannon and whether it's a good thing that he has flouted a subpoena from the January 6th Congressional Committee. And I think a couple of weeks ago, you joked with me, Rich, that I had written a nuanced piece that said that it was okay for the committee to hold him in contempt, but that the Justice Department shouldn't indict him. Well, they turned around and indicted him. It's fine for the committee to hold him in contempt, and also for the committee to do everything they can to try to get information out of him. You may believe, as I believe, that the committee, which is controlled by Democrats, is very political, and they're making their motivation here is to make a political case against Trump. And we've heard just in the last day, I think, didn't yesterday, they've now subpoenaed Alex Jones and Roger Stone. So, you know, this thing is, I kind of think it's going to be like a cross between entertainment television or reality television or, you know, whatever, when they have their hearings and bring these guys in to testify. So I'm not making an argument on behalf of the January 6th committee as if their motives were pure as the driven snow. And I'm not championing Steve Bannon here, because I happen to think that even if the January 6th committee is not going about this in a way that I am crazy about, this is a congressional investigation that Congress has a right to conduct. We talked about this before there was this committee. I was against there being one of these 9/11 commission style panels, because I thought this was for Congress to do itself, not to have a special committee come in and do it. I think it was completely wrong for Pelosi not to let McCarthy seat the people he wanted to seat, including Jim Jordan and Jim Banks, just because they're pro-Trump Republicans. If Adam Schiff can sit on this committee, then anybody should be able to sit. You know, if you're worried about people's bias that they bring to the table, but you're letting Adam Schiff and Jamie Raskin be on this committee, that's ridiculous. But this isn't about, the committee is a legitimate committee, even if it doesn't conduct itself in an exemplary fashion. And it's perfectly appropriate for Congress to be investigating an attack on Congress. So, you know, the thought that the endeavor is not legitimate is ridiculous. So Congress has every reason to subpoena people that they think have relevant information. And evidently Bannon was involved in the planning of what went on January 6th, at least at the Ellipse where Trump gave the speech. So that's all fine. The reason that it shouldn't be a prosecution is the Supreme Court in the post-Watergate era, in a case called Nixon versus Administrator, made what I think is a terrible ruling in saying that presidents who are no longer presidents, that former presidents, have executive privilege. Now, I think that that is a cockamamie view of constitutional law. I am strictly a unitary president thinker. I believe, as Justice Scalia said in his famous Morrison versus Olson dissent, that the Constitution reposes all of the executive power in a single person, a single officer, the president of the United States. That means the incumbent president. And I don't think anybody else in the executive branch has power. They're all delegates of the president's power. And I don't think anybody who's outside the government has any executive power. So the idea that a former president has executive privilege, I think the court got confused between the concept of executive privilege and the concept of personal property. It's long been the case that presidents, when they left office, they were deemed to be the owners of their own presidential papers. And they had an ownership right to weigh in on the disposal of those materials. But that's a completely different matter from when people subpoena things for purposes of whether it's congressional investigations or criminal investigations and the like. I don't think former presidents should be able to say, I have executive privilege and Congress doesn't get this or a grand jury doesn't get that. That should be up to the incumbent president. And if that means, you know, the incumbent president has a political vendetta against the former president and won't assert executive privilege, that's a stupid move for the incumbent president to make, because he's not going to be incumbent president forever. And there's going to be investigations 4 years down the road. And he's going to hope that his successor asserts executive privilege to protect whatever legitimately should be protected from the Biden administration. But whether Biden makes a good decision or a bad decision, it's his privilege at this point, not Trump's. So that's my view of it. But it's not the Supreme Court's view of it. I have a feeling if the Supreme Court gets another bite at the apple, it may become the Supreme Court's view of it. But the Supreme Court's view of it as of 1977 is that a former president has executive privilege, even if Congress enacts a statute that tries to take it away from them, because the court said that executive privilege is rooted in constitutional separation of powers, so it can't be undone by a statute. And even if the incumbent president does not agree with the former president's assertion of executive privilege, the court says the former president still has executive privilege, but it's qualified and it can be overcome based on the need of, you know, the importance of the investigation, the kind of executive interest that's being protected by the assertion. In other words, is President Trump just trying to protect himself, or is he legitimately trying to protect some kind of a national security or foreign policy interest? All those things would be weighed by a court. And the reason I didn't think that the Justice Department should weigh in here is because even if it's a frivolous claim, Trump has a right to assert executive privilege. And Bannon has a right to say that until the courts work out the full parameters of Trump's executive privilege, I'm not going to comply. But if Congress wants to go to court and the court says, here's what Trump's privilege is, and no, Bannon, you have to turn this information over, then Bannon is saying at that point, if the court rules, then I'll turn over the information. So I don't know how you prove criminal intent under these circumstances. And that's on top of the fact, Rich, that the Justice Department has not brought a case to defend a congressional subpoena in 40 years. This is the first time they've done this since the early stages, I think, of the Iran-Contra hearings. I think they've only done it like three or four times ever. A couple of them relate to Watergate, and I think there's one that's in the Reagan era. But since the early 1980s have they brought a case like this. And here they bring one under circumstances where Bannon's going to be able to say, the Supreme Court says Trump has privilege. All my lawyer said to the committee was, you want to go to court and work it out, or you want to have an agreement with Trump and work it out, and whatever they tell me I have to turn over, I'll at that point turn over. Now, Is Bannon playing games? Of course he's playing. He's Bannon. He's playing games. Yes. And just so people understand, this is like the greatest dice for him to roll in history, because what the Justice Department has indicted him on is a misdemeanor. It's like two misdemeanor counts. At most, he would face like about, even statutorily, he would face only about 2 years in jail. And the reality is, if he did 2 months in jail, that would be surprising. So he's got a good defense, and there's almost no downside to being, you know, he can roll the dice and go to trial. So if you really wanted him, you know, he can roll the dice and go to trial and get convicted and still face no time, more than likely, or very little. So if you really want Bannon's testimony, then what you would try to do is go to court and work out the privilege and get him to testify. By indicting him, he now has a Fifth Amendment privilege that he can add to Trump's executive privilege assertion as a reason for not cooperating with the committee. And between the trial and the appeals, he'll be able to tie this up for a couple of years. By the time they would get Bannon at the end of this rainbow, the Republicans will already have retaken control of the House and disbanded the January 6th mm-hmm. committee. So if you really want this guy's testimony, this is like the worst way to go about it. But yet again, it's the Biden Justice Department virtue signaling to the progressive left that, you know, we're with you and we're going to war with Trump's guys.
Okay, well, that's all the time we have. This podcast has been produced by the Incomparable Therapy. Thanks to everyone for listening. And thank you, Andy McCarthy.
Thanks, Rich.